Hey, it's Nancy. Before we begin today, I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Crime Beat early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
A listener's note. The following episode contains coarse language, adult themes, and content of a violent and disturbing nature, and may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
It's something that many of us could be asked to do. A chance to play a key role in our justice system and pass judgment on those accused of serious crimes. Any one of us can be considered for jury duty, and every year, thousands are called on to fulfill this obligation. It's a role that can come with significant stress, especially when the case includes disturbing evidence.
This wasn't ordinary for us. We don't sit through trials every day. Yeah, you see crime on TV. That's nothing. That's nothing like sitting in a real courtroom with a real crime in front of you.
When the first witness was called, that was Jennifer. That was it for me. I mean, I knew it was going to be intense when she described what she went through that first day.
I'm Nancy Hickst, a senior crime reporter for Global News. Today, a Crime Beat exclusive. You'll hear from two of the 12 jurors who decided the fate of Douglas Garland. This is Hunted by Evil, Inside the Jury. You'll remember from the previous two episodes that in the summer of 2014, Jennifer O'Brien went to pick up her 5-year-old son from her parents' home following a sleepover. But they weren't there. Instead, she found a crime scene. The bodies of Nathan O'Brien and his grandparents, Alvin and Kathy Lickness, were never found. 3 years later, in 2017, Douglas Garland stood trial for 3 counts of first-degree murder. Today, you'll hear from 2 members of the jury who heard the case. This is the first time any of the jurors have spoken publicly, and I'm grateful they're allowing me to share their experience with you. I need to tell you, in Canadian law, jurors are not allowed to disclose what was said during their deliberations, so that was off limits for our interview. In fact, they can't tell anyone, not even a counselor or a therapist, what was said in the jury room during deliberations. It's a criminal offense to reveal those conversations. That's because the courts want to protect a juror's privacy in the jury room, so decisions aren't influenced by potential negative public backlash in the future if the verdicts are controversial. Anyone convicted of disclosing jury deliberations could face a fine of up to $5,000 or jail for up to 2 years less a day or both. For safety reasons, I'm not using their real names, so I'll refer to them as Jane and Max. In December of 2016, they received a summons in the mail.
We had been away on a holiday, and so when we got our bunch of mail, it was in there. And I was right away concerned because it was time sensitive.
I got the subpoena in the mail and was told to show up at the courthouse, and no idea what the case was or what the reason was. But, you know, you get it. You've got to show up.
It's quite a process because, you know, you go through all the security, and then there's like over 1,000 people sitting in this big courtroom, and they just like eliminate, like they go through numbers and eliminate. And then after so many, you know, processes of elimination, then I went into the courtroom where I was asked a few questions, and I wasn't very familiar. I vaguely knew of a case with the 3 people, but vaguely.
So I show up there, and there's people everywhere, and so we're all in room. We're pushed into different rooms, and there's some people in the big courtroom and some people in a smaller area. And then people start talking, and people more bold than myself start asking the security questions and what's this all about, what's going on. And then I overheard one of the security guys telling another person that there was 470 some of us there, and that it was for a murder trial. And it was just a really unreal, surreal situation where you had all these people there, and then they started calling out numbers. And if they called out your number, then you move into a different room and you move up to the front of the court. And then they called a group of 10, and my number was called second out of the whole thing. So when we go into the little room, and then never really knowing what you were doing, I felt like, you know, it was cattle being moved from pen to pen, never knowing exactly what's happening. And then we went from that room one at a time into meet the judge and the lawyers. And they were allowed to ask us three questions, I think it was, whether we were aware of the case, we've heard of the case, and if we could be impartial.
This was an extremely high-profile case. And because of the amount of pretrial media coverage, nearly 500 people were called to the Calgary Court Center for jury selection. Garland's defense team successfully applied to screen possible jurors through Challenge for Cause, where prospective jurors were asked a set of questions designed to expose potential bias due to the publicity of the case. It's important to note that just because you're aware of a specific case doesn't mean that you won't be asked to serve on a jury.
I'm a bit of a news junkie. I watch all the news, and I knew who you were, and I had seen you chasing Garland down the street before I even knew that I was going to be anywhere near that trial. And so I was very familiar with it, but I was very confident that, you know, I could hear the what was to be said and make an informed decision. So I didn't think it was going to be a problem for myself.
I should add, there are a variety of reasons people are excluded from jury service. That includes some specific professionals, like judges and lawyers. There are others who can ask to be excused from jury duty. For example, public servants involved in the administration of justice and their spouses, and people with health or domestic obligations. This is up to the judge in each case. There are a lot of people who can't or don't want to serve as jurors. But again, it is your duty unless you can prove it otherwise and be granted an exemption.
It was also interesting because we had this little lunch break, and I went to get a bottle of water, and I'm talking to another person waiting. And, you know, she was really hoping to not get on the case. And she said, "Why would you want to be on it?" And then for some reason I did. And I remember talking to one of the other jurors too, feeling like this is a privilege to get to be a part of our justice system.
For me, I know a lot of people did want to get out, and some people were able or wanted to. They had other commitments, family commitments. For me, I was running my own business. I had people that I could count on. My wife and I worked together. I was fine with it. I was totally fine with it. And I thought it would be an opportunity to give back to the community. I was born here in Calgary, and so true Calgarian, and to give back to the community. But I had no idea what I was really getting into at that point. Then again, they start funneling you into another room. So I go into a room which turned out to be the jury room, and there was one guy sitting in there. And then I was in there, and then here comes a third person and a fourth person. And then as it went along, we realized that we were actually the jury, and at that point, we didn't even really know.
In most cases, there are 12 jurors selected. For the Garland case, two extra jurors were chosen to protect against a mistrial in case any jurors needed to drop out. So there were 14 jurors in total. Three women and 11 men were selected.
Well, the seriousness of the whole the whole courtroom, the rules. We were informed early and often about what we could do and couldn't do, and no cell phones, and who we could talk to and who we couldn't talk to, and that we weren't to watch the news. And, you know, so it started early.
As a journalist covering this case, I attended the preliminary inquiry, after which the judge determined there was enough evidence for the case to proceed to trial. There was a publication ban on details of the prelim, so I wasn't able to report on the evidence presented, but it did prepare me for the graphic details that came out during the trial. Jurors, on the other hand, had no idea what they were about to hear.
I think every day was a bit of a shock, to be honest. And that was quite something, looking him in the face and taking in the whole scene of the courtroom and the family. I think that was a big thing, just looking at all the people who were there. That was hard.
When the first witness was called, that was Jennifer. That was it for me. I mean, I knew it was going to be intense when she described what she went through that first day.
The evidence presented during the trial can only be described as horrific. One by one, investigating officers explained what they found at each of the different crime scenes. Sergeant Jody Arnes testified about the bloodstains at the Lickness home and explained how evidence showed that all three were likely still alive when they were taken. Senior Constable Ian Oxton fought back tears as he walked court through the forensic evidence found on the Garland property, including DNA of all three victims. Each investigator's testimony added pieces to the puzzle of what happened to Nathan and his grandparents.
I guess I've always had a respect for the investigators, but now such a next level of respect for all of them, all the different positions that were involved in helping to solve this. Just so much respect and just a realization of how incredibly hard their job is and this how engrossed they were in it for such a long period of time. I was looking at it for a couple of weeks. How do you do this every day of your life? I have no idea.
What a great job all the detectives and the Calgary Police, the RCMP, the Hawks helicopter, all the people that gathered the CCTV video, and the amount of evidence that was, you know, the 1,400 pieces of evidence, I think it was, that were gathered is just unbelievable. I had no idea, My only thing with police is my speeding tickets, so I had no idea that talented people were out there.
There was one officer, Constable Jamie Parhar, whose bubbly personality allowed for some welcomed smiles throughout her testimony.
I think it is easy to think of officers as just like 100% professional and out there running confidently, knowing exactly what's going on, and yet she was left in, like, kind of from bad to worse to worse to worse situation, where, like, this young woman, like, just left in this most unbelievable place. And yet, as she told about it, we all smiled. Like, I'm sure we all were smiling, and I don't think we ever smiled through any of the rest of the trial. So, it's so hard to put into words how much light she did bring into the courtroom. And again, just how much, I think how personally we probably all felt very personally involved, or like there with her in how she described it. You know, she's young enough to be my daughter. So to think of, you know, my daughter being out there and just how traumatic that must have been, how it all went down in the end, was just unbelievable. But how courageous she was and how, like, what a fantastic job she did. It was just amazing. I just could not imagine putting myself in her shoes.
Most evidence presented during the trial could make any person question their faith in humanity.
One of the things that stood out was the one man who had spent so many hours digging through the ashes.
There was distressing evidence that showed the victims were tortured, killed, and dismembered, their bodies destroyed. one day in particular stands out in my mind. There were tears in the courtroom as the jury was asked to handle an evidence bag holding two meat hooks. At the time, the prosecution said it was so they could feel their weight and strength. The trial continued for nearly 5 weeks. At the end of each day of evidence, many jurors still had their own responsibilities, like taking care of their families.
Thankfully, I was just launching a business at the time. So every night after court, I would go to work. So I worked basically every night. So I think that was a good distraction for me.
I think it's important to note, at the end of each day, as a journalist, I was able to discuss details of the case with others, but jurors are prevented from doing this by law.
That's something I didn't know before being on jury, that I thought us as jurors could discuss the case, but we couldn't, because otherwise we might persuade each other in a certain direction by just discussing. So all the time that we sat in the jury room or went out for lunch or had breaks, we could not discuss the case.
To not be able to come home and talk to your family about it, we were told not to talk to anybody, and you're right. We went to lunch with the other jurors, but we weren't even supposed to speak of any of it when we were outside of the jury room. So it was a strange situation. And then we sat in that jury room for many, many hours in between when there was breaks or when they were discussing what they were going to allow and what they weren't.
The justice presiding over the case took time on several occasions to encourage jurors and let them know he found certain testimony difficult as well. It's something Jane and Max both appreciated.
I thought it was really kind of him to acknowledge that this wasn't ordinary for us. We don't sit through trials every day. Yeah, you see crime on TV. That's nothing. That's nothing like sitting in a real courtroom with a real crime in front of you. That's not at all the same. And I just thought that it was kind. And I think that it did give us permission, it gave me permission afterwards to go to a counselor.
That judge, I mean, I'd love to have a beer with that guy. It was what a super great person and smart. And he had control of the courtroom and he was sincere and, yeah, and he was a human being. I mean, yeah, he had a couple tears in his eyes. Who wouldn't? If that's grounds for appeal, then we got a problem.
I should note here that the judge's comments were brought up by Garland's defense in the Alberta Court of Appeal, but the appeal panel stated they found nothing inappropriate about the comments, nor did they find the comments betrayed any bias on the part of the trial judge. Only 12 jurors would decide Garland's fate. But you'll recall that two extra jurors were chosen in case someone had to leave unexpectedly. On the 14th day of the trial, Justice Gates explained that one of the jurors was excused after their son suddenly passed away. That left 13 jurors to hear the case. Then, on the final day, one of those jurors had to be cut. That's because the Criminal Code of Canada does not allow for 13 jurors to deliberate. It states, if there are more than 12 jurors remaining, the judge shall identify the 12 jurors who are to retire to consider the verdict by having the number of each juror written on a card that is of equal size, by causing the cards to be placed together in a box that is to be thoroughly shaken together, and by drawing one card if 13 jurors remain, or two cards if 14 jurors remain. The judge shall then discharge any juror whose number is drawn. And that's exactly what happened.
Right to the bitter end. So he was there for all the evidence, all the closing arguments, everything, and then released before the deliberation. I saw him afterwards a few times, and I really, really felt bad for him. When you ask somebody to sit for 5 weeks to be so emotionally involved and then to get up and walk them out of the courtroom, in front of everybody. Like it, and then he had no say in anything. So I think that really bothered me, and it really bothered him. After, and the judge came into the room and spoke with him about, you know, this could be very hard on you. It was a weird situation.
The 12 who remained were sent to deliberate. And again, jurors cannot discuss what was said during those deliberations. After nearly 5 weeks, Max said he felt prepared to weigh both the prosecution and defense evidence.
I've already heard the case. I've already seen the pictures. I've already listened to all the testimony. I've got about, you know, 40 pages of notes. By that time, I'm ready to go. Let's finish this thing off.
It took jurors just 8.5 hours of deliberations to reach their unanimous decisions. Douglas Garland was found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Nathan O'Brien and his grandparents, Alvin and Kathy Lickness.
There was a feeling, even a sense, not seen, but practically such a strong sense of all this evil being lifted and released. And I hadn't realized how powerful that moment would be. I hadn't realized how much would be released in that moment, how much was hinging on that, how much hope would be restored in something. In those moments, it was so incredible to be a part of that I have such a new interest in justice, a new passion, a new, can't stop thinking about it, can't stop studying it, there's just something that makes me realize that as humans, justice is so important. And when we got to see the reaction and when we got to be a part of that, it was truly a miracle. And all of us did talk about that after, how shocking it was, how shocking it felt to just be a part of that moment.
And you're thrown into it. You get there and it's 5 weeks of intense trial. And then the verdict comes down, you walk out of the courtroom and it's over. I mean, it's almost the extreme of an athlete at the end of his career or something. And then you wake up tomorrow and then you have to deal with it. And there's nobody there you can talk to that has been through it. I would have liked to have seen possibly some, they offered us counseling, one-on-one counseling. And I did go to a counselor because I thought it would be wise to do that ahead of time at the end of the trial. But I didn't find that they really understood. I think what might really work for a jury is if they had a group session right at the end of the trial. Say the jury stays an extra day and just have a little group session and a little understanding of what's to come in the next month, 2 months, 6 months, for different people, it'll be different things. But I think it would be beneficial because it was intense and then it was over.
The people these two jurors think of the most are Alvin, Kathy, and Nathan's family, especially Jennifer O'Brien.
As a mom myself, with a child and a loving grandma, like imagining her walking into the house and the horror, the unbelief, the terror that she must have gone through as it starts to register. And then the phone calls and it's just so tragic.
The evidence they saw and heard during those 5 weeks will no doubt haunt them for the rest of their lives.
It was probably, a good 6 months for me, and I'm sure longer for others, 6 months of sort of processing, like daily, after going through that and just realizing, and not just processing like the gruesomeness and the evil, but also how our justice system works, all the different things that the investigators do, what's involved in this, what's involved in that, like all of it was just a process to go through and to understand. And it was, some of it was very hard and some of it was just great to know. Like I said, so just so amazing, all the different roles and all the different people involved in solving the case. The amount of hours that went into this is just mind-boggling.
Well, what I find is there are so many triggers. So every time I drive down Glenmore Trail, or I drive past the Balzac weigh scale, or I see a green Ford half ton, or all my locks on my house are Schlage 365s, or, you know, it's just on and on. I was last year at the Springbank Arena, and there was a picture of Nathan in the arena. There's a lot of triggers, I can tell you that for sure.
I asked them how they deal with the trauma that's been passed on to them.
You know, I just keep coming back to the family, and I keep pushing aside anything that, you know, woe is me, because it just is so devastating for the family that, you know, my little bit of a contribution or my little bit of pain or sadness, you know, I'm not going to say I haven't shed a few tears just randomly. When you get a few triggers like that day in the Springbank Arena, you just deal with it. Like we already said, you compartmentalize it and you push it aside and you say, I couldn't. There's nothing I could have done about it. I mean, if I could have been there that day, I would have been there. But there's nothing we can do at this point. And unfortunately, this kind of thing. Maybe not to this degree, but this kind of thing keeps happening over and over again. And it's a sad state why it happens in our society. I don't know.
This is what I take away from the case, that there's some pretty amazing people out there, you know, who work tirelessly with dogs. Like how the dogs contributed too, which is phenomenal, and how they contribute by spending their life training these dogs. Like every piece of this, there's so much that we can say about, okay, there's evil, but guess what? Justice prevails. And there's a lot of people who spend their whole life to make sure that it does. And they won.
Over the years, there have been calls for greater support for jurors in Canada. And a special steering committee has looked into some of the key issues and found there is room for improvement by provincial, territorial, and federal governments. I've spoken with several former jurors from other cases who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder from the graphic details they've been exposed to. So I wanted to know what feedback Max and Jane had, what they think could help make this civic duty a better experience.
I wish that at the end, they could have brought somebody in. You know, if we would have spent one more day there, and they could have brought somebody in that could have walked us through the emotions that we're going to have. I mean, most of us had never been through any real trauma in our life. You know, I've lived a pretty vanilla life. And so it would have been beneficial if we would have had a group session. So that would have been good. I don't know a lot about the American system, but I do know that it's completely different in that as soon as they're done, you know, they're interviewing jurors and their names and out there and public. And I'm not so sure that that's not a bad way to go, because then it gives the jurors a chance to say what they were thinking. I mean, we're not even allowed to discuss the deliberation. Or anybody's opinion in the room or how it came down or anything like that. We're not allowed to discuss it with anyone, even our family. And yet in the States, you know, it's all public. They get interviewed, they go on television shows and for the big cases. And I'm not so sure that I don't like that better. I think it would be more closure. In fact, speaking with you right now is closure for me. This is a great conversation for me. I really appreciate it.
I can relate to Jane and Max. They heard and saw the same horrific things I saw in covering this case. And as I mentioned before, this is one of the most disturbing cases I've ever covered and shared on Crime Beat. Thank you for joining me this week, and a special thanks to Max and Jane for sharing their experiences with me. Crime Beat is written and produced by me, Nancy Hickst, with producer Dila Velasquez. Audio editing and sound design is by Rob Johnston. Special thanks to photographer-editor Danny Lantella for his work. And thanks to Chris Bassett, the acting VP of National and Network News for Global News. I would love to have you tell a friend about this podcast, and you can help me share these important stories by rating and reviewing Crime Beat on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can find me on Twitter at Nancy Hickst, on Facebook at Nancy Hickst Crime Beat, and you can join me on Instagram at nancy.hickst. That's nancy.hixt. Thanks again for listening. Please join me next time.